Just like Vietnam, that's why the two are similar. And the Korean people heroically defeated the Japanese colonialists, and Kim Il-sung was one of the leaders of the guerrilla movement. And they thought, finally, just like the Vietnamese heroically mobilized under the communists to defeat the French imperialists, and both thought, oh, finally, we can rebuild our country and develop our economy. But then the United States, a new monster got involved, and that was the United States. And it was the United, with regard to Vietnam, you had the Geneva Accord that was supposed to promote free elections that would allow for the unification of a country just after the Vietnamese had defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu. But the Eisenhower administration acknowledged that Ho Chi Minh would win, the communist leader would win the election, with Eisenhower estimated about 80% of the vote. So they never signed the Geneva Accord, and they couldn't go forward with those elections. And they installed a Klein government and tried to build a government in South Vietnam. And the rest is history. It led to the disastrous and criminal war in Vietnam. And Korea, in the case, two U.S. colonels, one was Dean Rusk, the future Secretary of State, who had a connection with the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers were getting oil out of these countries, so they had their own agenda. And Dean Rusk and another colonel, Bonesteel, they created it's a 38th parallel dividing line that divided North and South Korea, and it was a completely arbitrary line. It had no historical basis whatsoever. And then they flew Syngman Rhee, who had been out of the country for 30 years or so, had lived in the United States and had no political backing in Korea. He was flown on an OSS airplane, and they installed him in South Korea, and they built up his army and police, and he surrounded himself with Japanese collaborators and massacred an estimated 100,000 South Koreans before igniting the war with North Korea. He never could have fought without the U.S. and the UN involvement. So again, Khan, I think, understood very clearly that this was basically a continuation of foreign colonialism, and that's how the Korean people saw it, and that's why they celebrate their victory as we would celebrate here. We celebrate the 4th of July, how the United States Americans rallied against the British imperialists and got their independence. And Koreans, hopefully one day the country will be united, and they will sell North Koreans celebrate their victory over the American invaders, and just like we celebrate the 4th of July. So it's not that different, really, and I think most people can clearly understand that. But in the McCarthy era, and even now, there's still a fog of propaganda that clouds people's ability to see it clearly. But Khan is one of the few of his generation who could see things very clearly. And he lived in Southeast Asia for a long time, so I think he understood the perspective of the people there very well, and he explained that in a lot of his writings.
Well, if I remember it, when things were getting sticky during the war between the two Koreas, with the UN Coalition of the Willing, or as it would be called in later years, fighting with the South and Red China, or the People's Republic fighting, supporting the North, MacArthur and I think Curtis LeMay too recommended using nukes.
Yes, MacArthur hatched a plan to use nuclear weapons on the border between North Korea and China. Yeah, because China, the Maoist revolution in China was also an anti-colonial revolution. See, I think here you have the legacy of McCarthyism and this Cold War mentality. So Americans or Canadians as well, conditioned to view Chinese Revolution 1949, the communists took over and we were fighting communism. And that's how it's taught in history courses, including at the collegiate level in most courses. But from their point of view, China had been a neo-colony of Great Britain, and the Maoist Revolution was really about reclaiming their country. And again, there are parallels with the United States and the fight against the British. And so that was seen as an anti-colonial revolution. And the Maoists were also, promoting programs to uplift the Chinese peasantry. And the Chinese supported North Korea and eventually sent a lot of troops. And they lost nearly 1 million men. And Mao Zedong's own son, Mao Anying, was killed in the Korean War. So, but there was a fraternal. Both those movements saw themselves as anti-colonial movements fighting against foreign imperialism, the United States. And the U.S. behaved brutally in Korea, as they did Vietnam, and Khan describes this. And he goes into the atrocities, and he had a discussion of the Phoenix program before it was even very well known in CIA Corps of the Cancer, which he refers to as the computerized murder program, which it was what it is what it was. They used computers to compile data on dissidents and develop blacklists. And then they would send the secret police agents to kidnap, torture, and often murder those on the blacklist. And that kind of approach, program was initiated in Korea. And actually, Khan goes into how Park Chung-hee, you know, the U.S., he makes the point that the U.S. tend to ally with some of the sleaziest people and you know, empower the most, the worst elements of that society, the worst opportunists who would kill their own countrymen. And he notes how Park Chung-hee, who became, actually was the Kennedy administration, and it's a myth. I've read this in some books that Kennedy was not an imperialist, and you know, he was going to, I mean, I think there were some good things about, he was going to withdraw from Vietnam, and he was making peace with the Russians. I think there's some, you know, good things that Kennedy was starting to do, but it's a myth that Kennedy was not an imperialist. And he points out that Kennedy, who backed a coup in South Korea, because there was a student revolt against Syngman Rhee, who was the original leader of the U.S. empowered, student revolt. So the Kennedy administration moves in to install Park Chung-hee, who became the dictator from 1961 till around 1980. And then his daughter came in a few years ago, and she was extremely right-wing. And Khan points out that he was the sleaziest opportunist. In the Korean War, he had collaborated with the Japanese, and then he was involved the Korean version of Phoenix, killing his own countrymen with these blacklists that they developed, and then, you know, the kidnapping and murder operations by special force units that he was commanding. So those are the kind of people the U.S. put in, as he points out, like Nguyen Cao Ky and Thieu in South Vietnam. These guys were gangsters involved in the opium, especially Ky was directly involved in the opium business, and he was like Yoshio Kodama, an outright gangster. And I don't think it's really controversial, as horrible a history as it is, and it sounds, I guess, to the innocent ears of some, you know, maybe students or people who grew up in America. If you were living in Southeast Asia at that time, you witnessed that. And it was known how horrible these people were that the U.S. was installing. And the U.S. was really hated. I mean, they behaved very brutally. The troops in Korea was like Vietnam. You know, they were committing My Lai-type massacres all the time. And there's a museum commemorating it in North Korea, Museum of American War Crimes. And an objective historian went there to assess. You can say, oh, that's North Korean propaganda. But these were objective, independent historians like Bruce Cummings and others. And they said that, unfortunately, the North Korean, I mean, obviously they have, maybe they're going to play up some things for their own political reason, but he said objectively there was a huge amount of evidence to verify a lot of those atrocities, you know, a large number of the atrocities that are showcased in that Museum of American War Crimes.
Again, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Jeremy Kosmarev. Jeremy is the managing editor at covertactionmagazine.com. He's the author of four books on U.S. foreign policy, including Obama's Unending Wars and The Russians Are Coming Again with John Marciano. You could write that again, I think, Jeremy. The Russians are coming again, because you were right in the middle of it.
Add one point to what you're saying, why it'd be important to study this history. And yet, and I was reviewing another book, and Khan goes into some of this, and there's a new book by A.B. Abrams published by Clarity Press called Atrocity Fabrication, and he has a whole chapter on Korea that's very good. Like what I was describing, these horrible war crimes committed by the United States that are well documented by independent historians, and there's even records about in the U.S. National Archives, which I've done some research in. But at the time, it was just the media reported that North Korea was committing all these horrendous atrocities, and they even had a film by Humphrey Bogart, you know, the famous Hollywood actor, narrated this film about war crime by the communists. And if you live in that period, you know, you've been inundated with propaganda And you would have the impression that the communists committed all the atrocities and were the barbarians. And so, I mean, that's why I think they have cut history education, because if you understand, and the reality, and we know for a fact, because there was a truth commission when South Korea did have a democratic revolution in the late 80s, and a truth commission was set up by a more enlightened leader named Kim Dae-jung, and that committed, you know, very detailed and extensive investigation into atrocities in the Korean War. And they found that 83% of the atrocities were committed by South Korean forces or the United States. So that's 83% versus 16 or 17%, and some percentage may have been unknown. So I don't know the percent of the communists, but let's say it was at most 17%, 83%. So that's which one side is clearly committing the vast majority of the atrocities. That's South Korea and the United States. Yet, if you and you can do a simple research project, you know those facts. Go back and read the New York Times or Time Magazine or Saturday Evening Post from the early 50s, and I did this myself. And you're inundated with story about red atrocities, and the communists are made to be look like barbarians, and every atrocity is blamed on them. And you would have that impression that it was a just fight. So if you understand that manipulation of public opinion and atrocity fabrication, misreporting, you could see that obviously the same thing is going on in Russia and Ukraine. And if and there's ever a truth committee, it wouldn't. I don't know the numbers, and I'm sure Russia has committed atrocities, as North Korea troops did commit some in the Korean War. But you know, the context is a little different in that war. But given the pattern, very likely that Ukraine has committed a huge number, the majority of the atrocities, if there's ever an independent truth committee, when the reporting is making the Russian to have committed all the atrocities. And we know from alternative reports that Ukraine is committing huge atrocity, whether it's shelling civilian area in Donbass and Donetsk, whether it's torture, whether it's beheadings of a prisoner of war. Some of that has come out in the open. So, but it's quite similar to what happened in Korea with the manipulation of public opinion. And again, Condi's work is very valuable in showing how that propaganda system functions and the interests behind it. And I think that would be a great education. But unfortunately, they don't allow this material in most schools, because I used to teach a course on the CIA at various institutions of higher education, and I was not very well treated, let's just say, from other faculty or administrators, although many students found my courses enlightening, and the student reviews were highly positive. Because students are open-minded at that age, I rarely encountered any resistance among students to objectively trying to learn about the history and manipulation of public opinion. It was only the administrators and other faculty.
Well, that open-mindedness is also viewed as an opportunity by the CIA, and they send recruiters covertly into universities and institutions of higher education. Absolutely. All the time.
And they insidiously plant their kind of people, the John Lewis Gaddises of the world, and there are plenty of them in higher education. And it would be good for more journalists to expose these people and the distorted history that they teach at schools like Yale, Harvard, many others, and how they contribute to what Noam Chomsky called the manufacture of consent, just like the media. And it's sad, really. I mean, there's so much potential in our society, and why do we want to go out and do these horrible things in the world? And most people don't. They want to, America to be respected. They want to do good in their own life, and they want to interact positively with other nations, not in this way of attacking them and murdering their people and lying about it.
When you're talking about blaming communists for all these atrocities that were actually being committed by the other side, it's an old trick to charge your enemy with the crimes that you yourself are committing, and we've seen it time and again and all over the place, actually. But it shows a lot of bottle. And now I mentioned you wrote a bunch of articles. I can't remember. I read about five of them, and I can't remember which article this one was in. But you're talking about the NED and this whole what we're hearing right now a lot lot of in the media is, oh, they're in here, they're messing with our democracy, they're trying to influence our democracy. And we're hearing arguments like that from like the National Endowment for Democracy itself. You're crying about this when that is their whole raison d'etre, is to go in and mess with other countries' political structure.
I mean, how do these people look themselves in the mirror? I mean, I guess they just have no shame in life that they spew BS day in and day out. You know, Damon Wilson and is the head now of the NED. It used to be Carl Gershman. But, you know, they go out and it's so hypocritical what they spew and so distorted. You know, it's hard for me to fathom how somebody would go about his life and feel good about himself, no matter how much money he makes or influence he gets in society, if what he's doing every day is a lie. And that's what they're doing. They're lying and brainwashing and distorting. I mean, the NED, one thing the NED focuses on is just like in the Cold War, you know, North Korean, they were spotlighting North Korean atrocities. So now it's the atrocities of Russia and China, and they try and promote, you know, dissidents in those countries. And I mean, there's some, you know, I think Russia and China do have some oppressive characteristics. So some of what they say is true, but they leave out so many other things, and often they're distorting. They're championing people who are actually trying to overthrow those governments, and would be treated. Some are dissidents or political prisoners or forced into exile. They would have to be in any country if their group's trying to overthrow the U.S. government. Like, look at the Proud Boys. I mean, they're going to end up in jail. Nobody would champion their cause really as the great freedom fighters. They're so selective. I mean, there's so much oppression that goes on in so many countries that they just ignore. So it's all it's a politicized agenda of spotlighting the oppression of any American enemy, real or exaggerated, and ignoring oppression where the U.S. is backing regimes, or within the U.S. itself. There are many oppressed groups. There are political prisoners in the United States. They're, you know, Native American, they're African Americans who've been subjected to mass incarceration and unfair policing. They wouldn't champion their cause. It's only some minority groups in Russia who are allegedly oppressed. And again, some of the circumstances are questionable. It's unclear what is going on exactly. So.
Well, you mean you're not afraid of the African People's Socialist Party taking over the United States at the behest of Russia? I mean, you've got an article up. Is this man a Russian agent operating in the black community of St. Louis? Some may be aware, but I mean, it would be risible. But these people are arrested and facing serious charges of sedition, or what is it?
Yeah, and that's a tragedy, because that group, the African People's Socialist Party, has done a lot of good in the black community in St. Louis, and Florida seems to where they operate the most. And I live in Tulsa, and I think Tulsa has a similar situation to St. Louis, where the city is still very segregated. And in Tulsa, you know, the north end, more African-American. And I think St. Louis, it's more east, northeast St. Louis. And that's where, you know, the Michael Brown incident occurred. And this group, you know, was raising funds. They built basketball courts, you know, for youth to play sports instead of being in gangs. They developed black-owned businesses. They developed a midwife program. They developed a program to help recently released prisoners, get job training and get, help them integrate in society. So they're really doing a lot of positive things for the community. It's their community, and they're working positively. And then this happened. They're accused of being Russian agents because he went to Russia. The leader, O'Malley Yeshitela, went to Russia like 7 years ago. His home was invaded by the FBI. All their files were stolen. He was treated. They sent in drones. I mean, it was a vastly overzealous police raid where it was like military tanks. And he's 80 years old. The leader, Yeshitela, the leader of the group, is 80 years old. He's written numerous books. He's very well-spoken, articulate guy. Imagine his home is invaded by drones and the FBI, and he could have even been killed. There are laser beams on him and his wife. They're basically terrorized. And I mean, they picked up on it one visit he made to Russia. And you know, I don't know if the group received some funding from Russians.
But this was all just a political ploy anyway to amplify the idea that America is under threat.
Yeah, this is exactly. You know, the Russians are coming again. They have nothing. Yes. So they got to pick on somebody. So they pick on this small African socialist group that had done a lot of positive for really downtrodden communities. And again, they may have, I don't know, if they got some money. They were desperate for money, and they, you know, this guy Ionov, there's some guy Ionov who Yeshitela was in contact with. How would he have known if he worked for the Russian government? You know, if he was somebody interested in supporting some of their campaigns or
it's all in the name, Mr. Kuzumarov, if that is your real name. Well, Jeremy, we're fast running out of time, but before we go, talking about a continuity and, you know, the future and the past, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. gave a speech throwing his hat into the presidential ring this past week. He mentioned some of the stuff that we were talking about, some of the stuff you don't hear anywhere other than, you know, like a Jimmy Dore show or the Gray Zone or some places like this on the far corners of the internet. He made it rather mainstream, talking about empire and overreach of the military. And Condi fingers John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s uncle, as being if there's one person most responsible for the Vietnam War, it was him. RFK's speech didn't go there, quite the opposite. But in the last minutes that we have, Jeremy, what's your impression of the RFK candidacy?
Well, I think you see that RFK is being smeared in the media, and that would get at what Condi's saying, about media, propaganda of the CIA and the intelligence agencies and their attempt to manipulate public opinion. Because here you have a political candidate emerging to the fore, and who is challenging many elements of U.S. Foreign policy. He challenged the dominant narrative about the COVID. I mean, he was very bold about that. His book goes into some of the CIA, the history of the CIA and manufacturing, biowarfare technologies and germ warfare, which was used in Korea, and how that may have been a precursor to the gain-of-function research that may have resulted in the manufacture of the COVID virus. So, I mean, it's very radical stuff he's writing about. And he's pointing to deep-rooted corruption and illegality in government in his book and his speeches. And he's talking about the dominance of corporate America and its takeover of the American political system. And he was critical, from what I saw, he's very critical of the war in Ukraine. And I think Robert Kennedy is the most courageous of all the Kennedys. And don't forget, his father was moving, Robert F. Kennedy Sr. was moving in a much more progressive direction. I think he was feeding off, before his assassination in 1968, he was feeding off the momentum of the student movements of the 60s, which was a very formidable force. It was against the Vietnam War. And whether Robert F. Kennedy Sr. was an opportunist or not is irrelevant to the fact that he was adopting, again, a more progressive platform and speaking out against the war in Vietnam. And I think the son has picked up on the best elements of the father, has courageously spoken out, again, against these corrupt factions in the government that are carrying out criminal activity and unethical medical experimentation, may have spread the COVID pandemic, and that were involved in these imperialistic foreign policies. So, I mean, kudos to him for speaking out and, again, picking on the best elements of his family's legacy. And then, of course, we see a media smear campaign that's been going on for years now against him, and that may make it very difficult for him to gain traction, although I think he's going to have a huge following in this election, and he may have an impact, and he's going to help educate a lot of people and better inform people about what's really going on. So I think it's a great thing he's doing, and kudos to him.
RFK Jr. mentioned the parallels between the moment of he now throwing his hat into the ring and when his father did back in 68. And it's quite striking. I mean, it's I guess if anything, we're going to know that there things the more they change, the more they stay the same. We keep fighting the same fights.
It seemed like deja vu. And then if the media smear, you know, they're really smearing him. They're going on overdrive. They're trying to invoke some, you know, elements of his family who may not agree with him to try and delegitimize him and blowing out of proportion some comments he once made or something like that. You know, the usual smear tactics. But if that doesn't work, if he really gained track, because look, Biden's 80 years old. I mean, 70% of the country does not want Biden to run again. And he's had a totally uninspired presidency. In any way, he'd been a horrible, disastrous president. And that's predictable because he'd had a horrible career for 50 years. He was associated with many of the worst policies in U.S. history, the crime bill. That led to mass incarceration, the Iraq War, just two of the most notable. And the guy's a dud. I mean, he finished near last in his class in law school. And this is the guy we produce. America is supposed to be such a great nation. And they produce this dud who's corrupt, has a corrupt family, and is a major war hawk, is threatening nuclear war, threatening both Russia and China. So, I mean, you know, almost everybody says we could do better than Biden. Here's Kennedy, you know, invoking the Kennedy name. You know, it's still a magical name. Probably, you know, if you really look into it, I mean, yes, there's a lot of dark side. And I mean, we shouldn't be under illusion about the Kennedys. And even Robert was not perfect at all. But again, there was, you know, Robert was, again, you know, playing off those 60s movements. And I think there would have been a lot of positive change if he wasn't assassinated. So look, he has the name. Let him play off that. If he's going to do good with that name, sometimes that's what you need. And, you know, somebody who had the star power or the family pedigree. And I think what he's saying is right on point. I think he's shown a lot of courage in what he said about the COVID, you know, speaking out against all these corruptions. And, you know, his book was very good. I read his book and it was very well researched, very eye-opening, very thought-provoking. And he had some good sections, again, on the CIA history and how that may have set the precedent for this unethical gain of function research. So again,
well, and the speech was excellent. I mean, he stood up for 2 hours. It seemed like he was reading without, you know, without notes. Imagine in the past couple presidents even standing for 20 minutes with a, you know, other than talking about toilet flushing and so forth. I mean, it was pretty inspiring from coming from me, a pretty jaded individual, I would say.
Very smart guy. And very knowledgeable, very passionate, and I think he's speaking out on the right issues. So, and I think he's going to have an impact. I think many Americans feel that way. Certain, you know, they have deep misgivings about many of these policies. They don't trust the government at all. He's going to draw a lot of conservatives. You know, there are a lot of the young people who were watching the Tucker Carlson show because Tucker Carlson was speaking out against the Ukraine war, spoke out against the COVID lockdowns, and he was starting to get a younger audience tuning into Fox. And I think Tucker Carlson, you know, now he's out, and you know, and there are some ugly things Carlson is associated with, but on a few topics, I think he was on point, and you know, young people are gravitating to him, and then they, and Carlson endorsed Robert Kennedy, so I think there's a younger generation that will, you know, does not want Biden, and I think will support Kennedy. So I think he could really shake things up in a Democratic primary, and they're going to use all methods of subterfuge and all the dirty tricks to try and isolate him and undermine him. And if they can, he would be in danger like his father, unfortunately. I had an article that showed there was clearly a conspiracy behind the murder of Robert Kennedy, and that was another great atrocity and tragedy for American politics, because I think positive change would have occurred under Kennedy, and instead we got Nixon and Reagan and Trump and Bush, and it's been a horror show ever since Robert Kennedy's death.
Well, and certainly Robert Kennedy Jr. believes that the official story on his father's assassination is inadequate, to put it mildly.
My article on it, the facts are clear. Just the number of bullets, it's impossible that Sirhan could have been the lone assassin. And in fact, the angle at which Kennedy was killed, the bullets that killed him, it couldn't have come from Sirhan's gun. So there were other assassins in the room. Sirhan was clearly set up as a patsy.
It's Dealey Plaza again, but inside. And Robert Kennedy Jr. was actually there with his father when this happened. Jeremy, there's a ton more, and we didn't get to all the articles that you've been writing. You've got a half a dozen of them in the last couple of weeks or so, and they're fantastic. And also, covertactionmagazine.com features other writers with there's too much to go into. It's just terrific stuff. Again, it's the spring fundraiser. Blow the whistle on U.S. imperialism and help CAM. Keep going. covertactionmagazine.com. Thanks a lot, Jeremy. I always learn from your articles and from our discussions, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come on today and talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I enjoy the discussion very much as well.
Till the next time, then.